Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Monday, November 14th, 2011, and this is podcast number 49. Hey, I got it all right on the first time that time. Did you see me? I'm getting better. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about today was a book that I've just finished. And normally, this is a 1,200-page book. And normally, I go into a 1,200-page book by going, I'll read that later, and I put it back on the shelf. That's not always the case, but a book really has to grab my attention and hold it for me to stick with it for 1,200 pages. And this book did. It's not just the subject matter, although the subject matter couldn't be better. It's just the writing. It was so gripping, and it's done so well that I just couldn't wait to get back into it every moment. The name of the book is Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism. This book just blew me away. I've put off reading this book now. I think it came out in, I'd have to look in the front of it, but I think it came out in like 2006. I think it was published in 2006. I think it was actually, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it came out in 2006. Anyway, if I would have had a brain, I would have brought the book up to my desk when I started this podcast, but I didn't do that. Anyway, so Holzman, his style of writing, I should clarify. Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism is a biography of Ludwig von Mises. It's written by a renowned scholar. Holzman just does a fantastic job writing this book. He takes a topic, this the life and life work of an individual, and he lays it out like, I don't know, somewhere between a fantastic novel and a fairy tale. It's just gripping, and as you're going page after page, the pages just whip by. And due strictly to his writing style, of course the topic matter is wonderful, but the amount of research that he would had to have done to go into the kind of detail that he goes into. Let me pull this up real quick on the internet so I get the right years. Delay while I look on the internet. Okay, what I really quickly looked up there was the dates involved. Ludwig von Mises was born in 1881, and he died in 1973. Now, let's put this in perspective. He was born in Eastern Europe in 1881. Now let's think about some things that were going on in 1881. Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell worked together to form the Oriental Telephone Company. The first fully feminist newspaper was published. Kansas was the first state in the U.S. to prohibit all alcoholic beverages. So this was like the very beginning of the temperance movement when Kansas outlawed alcoholic beverages. James A. Garfield was president of the United States in 1881. Tsar Alexander II of Russia was assassinated that year. The Boer Wars began in South Africa. Oh boy, you know what? I need to do a podcast on the Boer Wars. That is a podcast all on its own right there. A lot of people will judge the mess that was the 20th century on World War I, and they will say that World War I happened and that caused all the militarization and all the century of warfare and mass murder and everything else that the state did in the 20th century, and they'll very often bring that to World War I as the catalyst for that. And I would say no, actually the Boer Wars caused that. The combination of the Boer Wars and America's newfound policy in dealing with Spain in the Spanish-American War, those two events coincided to, and actually there was a series of Boer Wars, but it's beside the point. Those events, the Boer Wars and America deciding that it was going to become an empire, happened before World War I, and they set the stage so that World War I was almost inevitable. And of course, World War I was the thing within the 20th century that perpetuated an entire century of the state just mass murdering at a scale that it had never, ever imagined possible before. Anyway, so 1881, and Ludwig von Mises is born. Billy the Kid escaped from jail in Lincoln County, New Mexico. So that's the time frame we're talking about. Billy the Kid escaped from jail the same year Ludwig von Mises was born. Let's see what else we have going on. Oh, actually, Billy the Kid was shot that year as well. So that's the year that Pat Garrett allegedly shot Billy the Kid. Sitting Bull surrendered his troops. And in September of that year, James A. Garfield, President of the United States, was shot and killed. Therefore, Chester A. Arthur became the 21st President of the United States. Let's see. Oh, the gunfight at the OK Corral happened that same year. So the year Ludwig von Mises was born, the gunfight at the OK Corral happened. So we get a picture of what was going on in other places in the world. But these things were vastly different than what was happening in Eastern Europe. There was a lot of the old world that was dissolving in Eastern Europe. Germany, Bismarck was in the process of unifying Germany into a single nation state. It had previously not been a nation state. It was a loose confederacy. And Bismarck, both forcibly and by the use of politics, I suppose that is forcibly, isn't it? But anyway, Bismarck, in a horrible, wretched campaign, united Germany and pretty much forced Austria's hand in taking a particular position with Germany. And this really upset the balance that had happened throughout the Germanic-speaking people for, you know, a long time. They had been relatively stable, and now all of a sudden they're having to deal with a German state in their midst. This caused mass waves of immigration. The uniting of the German state caused mass waves of immigration into the U.S., as people fled the state in Germany, coming to the U.S. to get away from the oppression that the state was bringing. Prior to this, Germany being not a single nation, it was relatively free and a relatively good place to live throughout, going all the way back through the Dark Ages. It was, you know, much better than some other places where kings held unfair amounts of power. Okay, so this is where we start the book in 1881 with the birth of Ludwig von Mises. And you kind of get an idea of the things that were going on at that in that time frame. As and the book, and I should clarify the title because a lot of Americans are going to be taken back by the title. Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism. Now, keep in mind that what Americans call liberalism is not what Europeans called liberalism, especially not in the early part of the 20th century. Liberalism in Europe, in the European sense, especially in the early part of the 20th century, literally meant libertarianism. In the U.S., the liberals that we know of today took over that title starting somewhat in the 1930s, but they didn't really take hold up until in the 40s and 50s, and they latched onto that name. I mean, let's just be honest. Liberals in the U.S. are socialists, and they tend to be communist socialists, although some are more towards the fascism side. But typically speaking, liberals in the U.S. are communist-style socialists. Now, when we talk about liberalism in the classical sense, in the sense that Europeans would have talked about liberalism in the early 20th century or in the late 1800s, they were speaking specifically of libertarianism, of free market capitalism in the laissez-faire sense, restricted government, if government at all. And this was the sense that this phrase is used in reference to Mises. He was called by his colleagues the last knight of liberalism, because in an age when socialism was sweeping the globe, and literally one country after the next was embracing socialism, and all the popular economists and all the popular politicians were all embracing socialism, Mises stood alone, giving a logical and not only a philosophical and a logical argument as to why socialism simply could not work, what the flaws of socialism were, in a very logical pattern. And he did this almost unopposed. Anybody who would try to take him on a large logical argument would simply fail, because they would have to fall back on old, disproven, well, let's take Keynes, for instance. Keynes came out with his basically an apologetic for socialism. John Maynard Keynes's explanation of economics was essentially a justification for fascist-style socialism. And Mises read it, and he was just like, I'm not even going to comment on this. There's nothing new in this. What he does say has been disproven over and over, so it's not even worth my time. But yet, Keynesianism caught on, because it was popular, because the governments who were growing at a tremendous rate in the early 20th century, those governments sought desperately justification for their behavior, and Keynesianism provided that justification, while Mises stood right in their face saying, it won't work because of the price mechanism, it won't work because of this, it won't work because of that, it has proven itself not to be able to accomplish this, it can't do that. And Mises just laid down the reasons in clear, perfect logic, in ways that when people would hear him, they may not have bought one of his books, or they may not have been convinced by writings, but when they would hear him and they would understand what he was saying and the way he presented things in such a straightforward, simple manner, it was life-changing for people. Unfortunately, you know, he would have audiences of 15, 30, even 60 or 100 at the most, and that was typical for the day of a scholar. Of a scholarly lecture like this, you're going to have the size of a class, or you're going to have a few interested intellectuals. You're not going to reach the masses. And so the masses were taken in by things like, you know, food rations and free medical care and promise of free retirement and all these things. The hype of let's tax the rich and make them pay their share. And getting back to the book, Hulsemann, I can't emphasize enough the beauty of his writing in this. It's just so smooth, and it's just so, it just draws you in like you're reading a fairy tale, or like you're reading a wonderful novel. But it's real, it's true, it happened to this man. One of the things that really struck me was... Hulsemann uses letters of the day and writings of the day, and not only Mises, but of colleagues and of contemporaries and so forth. And he really, he has all the documentation. I don't know how much time he must have spent on this, but I can't imagine anyone having enough free time to do this much work. But anyway, he describes the state of Vienna, the state being the condition, not state as in capital S state, But the condition of Vienna around the turn of the century, going into the 20th century, and how the emperor, if you were in Vienna, Vienna was not a huge city. It was not like Paris or London. It was a very old city, and it was a very beautiful city, but it was not that big, especially the inner city part of it. And so you could be on the street. If you were on the street at the right time, at the same time every day, the emperor exited the government buildings, got in his coach, and casually rode in his horse-drawn coach back to the imperial palace. And you can't do that if people hate you. You can't do that if you're ruling, if you're an unjust ruler ruling by force and through the methods. Well, I read about Tsar Alexander II? Was that who that was? 1 second, I'll get back to that. Yeah, Tsar Alexander II was assassinated by, they threw a bomb at him, and I recall he was in a car. Or maybe he was in a car. No, he wasn't in a car. There was no cars at that time. So he must have been in a horse-drawn coach of some kind. Anyway, so the Russians killed Alexander II. Now, anybody could have killed the Emperor of Austria around 1900 because he was so accessible to the public. But no one would have even considered that because he was not that kind of a forceful top-down leader. He was doing everything possible to try to modernize the country and bring the country's economy into a modern economy and all these things. Now, yes, it was true that eventually Archduke Ferdinand, I believe it was the emperor's nephew, if I recall correctly. Anyway, he was not in Austria. He was visiting one of the satellite countries where there was a lot of unrest, and Austria was in the process of negotiating. There was some tension, and Austria was in the process of negotiating the situation, and it probably would have been resolved, and it probably would have been resolved in the best way for the locals, for the local people there. Instead, there was the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, and of course, that's what one of the major things that pushed the world into the First World War. But back in Vienna, there was not that kind of animosity for the emperor. You could literally, as it says in the book, be walking down the street and see him step out of the government offices, get in his coach, and ride down the street. And it was that level of personalness to the empire. Reading all the details about what the place was like and what it was like being in Vienna at that time frame, and how Ludwig von Mises, how his family worked, and how his mother basically meddled in his marital affairs and ended up ruining his first and almost only chance at having a wife. And then later, once his mother died, he felt free to go ahead and marry who became the love of his life. And the story involving that, I mean, the book is tastefully specific in the whole romance, the relationship and the romance and the eventual marriage, and then the latter relationship of Ludwig von Mises and his wife, and just a wonderful, touching story. Also, understanding, I've known a lot about Ludwig von Mises for a long time. I thought I knew a lot about him, that is, until I read this book. I had no idea that he held the level of respect that he had in the world, in economics, and specifically in Austria and the German-speaking world prior to the 1930s. When the Nazis when they started coming into power in the early 1930s, perhaps Mises' position got a little bit dangerous, But in ways, he even became more important to all those who were opposed to the fascist regimes that were popping up all over Europe. The book goes into great detail, explains Ludwig von Mises's service in World War I, his original writing. Oh, here's a neat thing. His first book, when he finally got his first book written and got it published, he was thrilled that he got, and I'm going to mess up the numbers, but adjusted for today's economy, it was something like $16 or something like that that he got paid, or $14 or something, adjusted for the economy, that he got paid for his first book. The problem was, the nation was in the midst of hyperinflation at the time, so by the time, from the time that he got the book published to the time that they actually issued him his payment for the book, the value, because of hyperinflation, the value dropped to something like $4 or $6 or something like that. I can't remember the exact figure. But it was like it was in the teens at best, and then hyperinflation hit, and it's just a few dollars. And that's what he got for his first book. But he was thrilled because he was able to actually publish a work. So he was thrilled by it. And then later, you know, the book tells the story of how he had to flee first Austria. He fled Austria literally as the Germans were marching in. As the Germans came in, they have a list of Austrians who were to be arrested on site and who whose property was to be confiscated and everything. And Ludwig von Mises was very prominent on that list. So within days of the Germans moving into Austria, they had ransacked his apartment. They had confiscated all of his library. They confiscated his financial, his bank accounts and so forth. They froze all of his assets. They confiscated all his family's inherited items that he had that had been passed down through his family to him. And the Germans then, that was the last Mises saw of any of that stuff. They whisk it away as they did in their efficiency. Close to the end of the war, the Russians actually captured a train that was hauling a lot of stuff that the Nazis were trying to get away with. And within that train, the Russians found Ludwig von Mises's many of, not everything, but many of the things from his apartment that had been looted, including his library and so forth. So the Russians then, of course, they weren't necessarily fans of Mises, considering that he had disproved their entire economic processes. So the Russians locked away this stuff until well after Mises' death. He never saw any of it again. But eventually, Husman and others have been able to get information from the Russians now and helped in the compilation of this book. But so eventually, Ludwig von Mises got married. He fled from the Germans and just barely escaped Austria in time to get to Sweden. I'm sorry, not Sweden, Switzerland. In Switzerland, he actually, there was a German kidnapping attempt upon he and his wife that he narrowly escaped. And in at this time, he was in his mid-50s, and he taught himself how to drive. He'd never knew how to drive before that, so he taught himself how to drive. And evidently very poorly. He was evidently a very poor driver his whole life, but he loved to drive. And so the book tells about his driving adventures and how he tended to get in really nasty wrecks, sometimes endangering his life, actually. But he survived it, and eventually, as the Nazi influence grew and grew, he decided that it was best to try to get out of Switzerland and get to the U.S. Now, this is a really interesting part. If you've ever seen any of the old movies, like Casablanca, is a perfect example, because in the movie Casablanca, there are people from all over Europe that are attempting to get out of Europe and get to the U.S. That's the whole point of the movie. And So the, one of the ways that they're trying to get out of the out of Europe and get to the U.S. is to, is if they can get to Spain or Portugal, and from Spain or Portugal, then they can fly to the U.S. So in the movie Casablanca, the method is to get to the city of Casablanca in Morocco, and there they can then get transport to, I can't remember if it was Spain or Portugal, and from there they can get a plane or a boat, and they can get to the U.S. I believe at that time you'd have to take a boat from that distance, but they were jumping, in the movie they were using a plane to jump from Morocco over across the Straits of Gibraltar. And so Mises pretty much went through exactly that. He fled with his wife, and they his wife had children from a previous marriage. I believe she was a widow, and had at least one, and I'm not sure how many children. I'm sure it says it in the book, but for some reason it skips my mind. Anyway, but they were adult children, and so the daughter was stuck in France, and they lost touch with her for some time. Eventually, she made it to freedom, but it was a very touch-and-go thing there for a while. Mises and his wife made it across France and attempted to get into Spain, and there was all kinds of problems, and they were delayed on the border. They couldn't get through for technical reasons, and they're, and things were really starting to look pretty bad. And then, just a series of events took place, and they were able to get to the U.S. almost miraculously, if you can accept that as a possibility. One might make the argument that it was miraculous that he got out of Europe. So he got to the U.S., and then he was destitute. I mean, he had no form of income. All of his income was either, his assets were either frozen in Europe, or payments that he was receiving through through England, through publishing rights, were all being frozen in England because you couldn't even send money from England to the U.S. at the time. At this time, Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, who was a student of Mises, was living in London. And so in order to get money to Mises, Hayek handled his Mises's books in London for him because he had this income coming in from book royalties. So Hayek would buy rare collectible books, and then he would send the books to Mises, and then Mises could then sell the books in New York, and you know, have some spending money from this. So this was the only way that they could move wealth from Mises's accounts in England to the U.S. in the early part of the war. So here was Mises stuck in New York. He had no real form of income. He at first he really didn't have any connections. Eventually, he started making those connections, and he started getting to the point of where he could start to make a living again. Things were, it was a real struggle for them. His wife considered taking secretarial positions, and she even trained for that. And once again, you know, Hulsemann, as he writes this story, it's just, it's beautiful. His writing is just beautiful, and it's enticing. It just makes you want to read it and read it. 1,200 pages, I think I mentioned. Anyway, let's go back a little bit. I've kind of done this whole book in chronological order, but let's jump back. Hulsemann doesn't necessarily go in chronological order. He does kind of go in chronological order, but he goes back and forth a little bit, but not enough to confuse you. It's really easy to follow his leaps in time. But if you go back to the early part of the when the Great Depression really started to hit, the stock market in the U.S. crashed and so forth. At the time, Mises was saying things like, "It's no, don't go and try to put on a bunch of, like the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Don't do that. That's wrong. Don't try to increase the taxes on the wealthy to pay, you know, to pay their share or whatever." Don't try to push more credit expansion and more money printing. And no, don't do these things. Exactly what the government of the U.S. did that drove the Depression worse Mises was saying, don't do those things at the time. And as Hulsemann lays these things out in the book of what Mises was saying, keep in mind, this was written in 2006, and this was before the housing bubble crashed and before George W. Bush started pumping money into industries and the too-big-to-fail nonsense and all the bailouts were going on. Before all that was happening, Hulsemann was writing this about Mises. And you can take those words of Mises and put them right into 2007 and 2008. And he could have been saying those things to George W. Bush and the Republican-controlled government and of the U.S. at the time. And yet, Bush did exactly the mistakes that Herbert Hoover did, which caused the Great Depression to get worse, which caused, in Bush's case, caused the whatever we want to call this current problem, caused it to get worse. And then in comes Franklin Roosevelt, which he had the opportunity to fix things, and yet he did exactly what Hoover had been doing, except way more of it. Now, that's exactly what Obama did when Bush had fouled things up so bad, and Obama comes in and had the opportunity to fix things by just turning it around and doing the opposite. But no, he couldn't do that. He did exactly what Bush had been doing, but did more of it. And it drove the economy right down into the toilet. That's exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did. And that's exactly what Mises was saying all those years ago. What is that? 70, 80? 80 years ago. Mises was saying this stuff, saying that this will make the Depression worse, and it did. And that's exactly what made the current financial mess worse in the U.S. and globally, too. So you could literally take Hulsemann's writing from 2006 and see the pattern in 2007 and 2008. It's brilliant. So eventually Mises was able to secure himself a position in the U.S., working with other libertarian personalities, and was able to begin to support himself and continue on his life work. But there was this time frame where Mises had just decided, and he had written, and Hulsemann goes through with personal letters that he had written to different people, and he had written to Hayek, and Hayek was still in London at the time, and he says, well, I'm not publishing anything. I have no intention of publishing anything. What I'm doing now is my posthumous work. In other words, I know that within my lifetime, no one will listen to me ever again. So I'm continuing to write and continuing to do my work so that after I'm gone, people can look back and see this. What a sacrifice, and what a thing to go through your mind. Now, he was wrong, because within a couple of years, people began listening to him again, and there was a rebirth of Mises' thought in the 1950s. This was what Hulsemann calls the second Mises Revolution. The first took place when Mises was at the peak of his influence in Austria in the 1920s and early 1930s. And then this second rebirth of the Mises Revolution in the 1950s when mountainous intellectuals like Rothbard and the list goes on, picked up the sword and picked up the lamp and stood with Mises and gave this movement a second life. Now, like I said earlier, let's see, Mises died in 73. Unfortunately, that was way too early. Of course, he was like 92 at the time, something like that. But, you know, if he just could have held out a little longer to see the internet and to see the explosion of the third Mises Revolution. Right now, everybody talks about Ron Paul and everybody recognizes Ron Paul, and he is a very well-known figure in politics right now. Third run for president. Very few of us remember his first in 88 when I first voted for Ron Paul. And he got a lot of attention in 2008, and now in 2012, he's getting the most amount of attention that he's ever gotten because the media seems to have a fascination with ignoring him, no matter what the numbers say, and no matter what the support says. But Ron Paul is a shadow. I'm not saying anything bad against Ron Paul. Ron Paul is, I would love to meet Ron Paul. I think he's a neat guy. I'll bet he would be wonderful to have at a barbecue or something. But in comparison to Ludwig von Mises, Ron Paul is a shadow. Ron Paul is a blip on the radar. Ron Paul will be forgotten. Ron Paul will never have the impact that Ludwig von Mises has already had. And what we're seeing right now is the birth of a movement that is not going to take us to liberty, but it will bring about the next birth of the liberty movement, which will be so much greater than the last. If you see the magnitude of what happened in the first Mises revolution, we have Hayek as the, in a sense, the child of the first Mises revolution. And then the second Mises revolution, we have Rothbard as, in a sense, the child of the second Mises revolution. And Rothbard, still as brilliant as he was, is still a shadow. Mises is the one in the spotlight. And now here we are in the third Mises revolution. And we have Ron Paul, and we have great intellectuals on our side. You know, Hans Hermann Hoppe, Holtzman himself, great intellectual. Roderick Long, Stefan Molyneux. We have these intellectual giants, and they're shadows compared to Mises. They're just shadows. And when the fourth revolution takes place, who knows who those leaders will be? Who knows who those intellectuals will be? And who knows when that will happen? It could happen 10 years from now. It could happen 50 years from now. But each one of these takes a strike at the state on an intellectual level that builds a foundation that someday will bring the crushing end of the state. Now, someone will say, well, Ludwig von Mises was not an anarchist. Well, he wasn't right on everything. None of us are. No one's right on everything. But Ludwig von Mises laid the foundation. And if you read through his work and you take it to the next logical step, which is what Murray Rothbard did, then you have anarchism. And you have, within the writings of Ludwig von Mises' work, you actually have statements in there that basically are the essence of anarchism. It's just that he couldn't make that leap, considering where he got his income, considering how he had been raised under the emperor in Austria, considering everything that he had experienced in his life. He couldn't fully make that leap to say, yes, we can live without the state. But Rothbard was there to make that leap. And now we have, as I mentioned, Hoppe and all these others, Robert Higgs, that was on the that we interviewed here at badquaker.com. Robert Higgs is right up there in that same classification of intellectuals that are setting the pace to take us into the fourth Mises revolution. And each one is getting more intellectual. It's like that snowball going down the hill. It's just building up more and more as it goes. So that's my sales pitch. This is my sales pitch for this book, Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism by Holtzman. You have to pick this thing up. It's, I don't even know how much it is. Let me look over real quick. Okay, so if you buy it, and this is hardback version, if you buy it from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, it's $43. That's the nice version. This is a nice library worthy version of this book. And $43 from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. However, if you would like to read this and you don't want to spend $43, or if, now, for me personally, I I love books. I have, I don't know how many books I have. I'd be afraid to even make a wild guess. I have so many boxes of books that I don't even have any idea how many books I have. So to add a book like this, for me, to add a book like this to my library is just something that I seek to do all the time. But if you'd like to read this and you don't necessarily want a hardback version, or you don't want to spend $43 on a book, just go over to the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org, and I'll put a link on Bad Quaker to this too. You can download the PDF version. You can download the, I believe they have the, is it iBooks or what is the format? Anyway, I'm pretty sure they have it in several formats there, and they even have a MP3 version. Let's see if I can find that real quick. And the PDF is free. You can download it for free. Now, I suspect that if you download it for free and you listen and you read it, you're going to want the hard version. And that's how Mises.org actually is able to offer these books free as PDFs and so forth, because they know that once you read these things, you're going to just want to put it in your library. Or in some of the other books, some of the paperback books that they offer, you're going to want to buy them and give them to your friends. So that's how the Mises Institute makes money on these things, by giving away whole books in PDF form and in audio form. But they do have it in both free download as a PDF. They have it free chapter by chapter in MP3 version, and it's right there available. And you know, there's really no excuse not to at least test the waters and see what you think. If you go and download the PDF and it takes you like 2 minutes or something, and you read the first chapter and you're like, Ben's crazy, this is boring, or this is stupid or whatever, well, what are you out? You're out nothing. You're out a couple minutes of your life, a few minutes of reading and a couple minutes of downloading. But I don't think that'll happen. I think you'll start reading chapter one and you're going to say, I have to figure out how I can have time to read all 1,200 pages of this. Because that's what I did. I try to get in several books a year. I don't always read as much as I'd like to. In September, I just finished a wonderful book by Stefan Molyneux about morality. And it was pretty good. But honestly, it took some struggle to get through it, because there's a lot of repetition, and Stefan is a great writer, and I love reading his stuff, but I had to work at it to get through it. And when we're having a lot of sleepless nights with health problems with my wife's mother, and the travel that we were dealing with, and back and forth from state to state, I wasn't getting the kind of sleep that I would have liked to have had. So it was difficult to read Stefan's book and stay awake, you know. And reading Hulsemann's Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism, I didn't have that problem. I didn't have any tendencies to want to nod off. I just couldn't wait to when I was reading it, I couldn't wait to get to the next page. And when I was not reading it, I couldn't wait to get back to pick it up and read it again. And I actually spent too much time reading it. I should have been doing other things, but I just couldn't put it down. And when I was away from it, I couldn't wait to get back to it. It's just a wonderful book. I know this is probably getting boring, but really, download it. Download the PDF. Read the first chapter. See if I'm not right. And I think you'll agree with me. And if you have the money, you know, you're supporting the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and so if you have the money, just go ahead and buy one. I don't get any money from this at all. It's just, you know, you buy it straight from the Mises Institute. I don't get any kind of credit for the link or anything like that. I doubt that they know I exist. Although, you know, I've talked to a couple of them over there, but in general, they don't know much about Bad Quaker. So I'm not making any money off of this. I'm not getting any notoriety from it. Thanks, folks. I know that was kind of a long thing. It's just that I'm so impressed by this book. I don't know when I've been hit, when I've been struck by a book this deeply. So thanks for listening. We'll try to be back tomorrow with another article. And if all goes well, we will be back Wednesday. Kai will be with me, and we will try to get another podcast on the air with Kai. Or we might do that tomorrow. We'll see how it goes. You never really know around here. We're pretty random. Thanks a lot, folks, for listening to BadQuaker.com. Bye.